Welcome back. Today, we'll be talking about chronic pain. Chronic pain is a serious condition that affects many people. It can interfere with day-to-day activities and even lead to depression or anxiety. I'm very happy to be joined by Dr. Gregory Rudolph from Swedish Health Services in Seattle. Dr. Rudolph is board certified in pain medicine, addiction medicine, and medical acupuncture. He is also certified and residency trained in family medicine and brings a longitudinal whole person perspective to his work with patients who suffer from chronic pain and substance use disorders. Dr. Rudolph works in a multidisciplinary pain management specialty clinic as part of a team and finds a collaborative and holistic approach to be indispensable in achieving good outcomes. He is the current chair of the American Society of Addiction Medicine Pain and Addiction Committee and the president of the Washington Society of Addiction Medicine. He's on the clinical faculty of the University of Washington School of Medicine. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Rudolph.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Johanna.
Welcome. Great. Let's begin. So what are the different categories of pain that an individual can experience?
Well, generally, pain can be broken into a few things that we talk about kind of in medical circles. The type of pain that is most related to an obvious injury would be called nociceptive, which is kind of a fancy word for just the pain you feel when you have, you know, something hit you or you mm-hmm. fall and, you know, scrape yourself. That's nociceptive pain. Another type of pain would be inflammatory pain, which sometimes can be caused even without any outside influence. It could be, say, your body's own immune system creating an inflammatory response that is, you know, not in anyone's interest. It's not in your own interest, but you have maybe a disease that causes this autoimmune inflammatory pain to strike up in, say, your peripheral joints or in your back. An example of that might be rheumatoid arthritis, which is a particular type of arthritis. It's an autoimmune condition. So that's an inflammatory pain. There's another type of pain called neuropathic pain, which is where basically there's irritation of nerves. And a classic example of that would be a person with diabetes, which is a fairly common chronic condition where nerves can be affected and can essentially have kind of hypersensitization to pain, most commonly in the peripheral extremities, like in the feet. And so you hear a lot about folks with diabetes developing pain and numbness in their feet. And sometimes they even get injuries because they don't feel if they have, say, a cut on their foot. And so they can get infections and all kinds of problems with their feet. So that's called neuropathic pain. So those are kind of the basic. And then there are people who have pain conditions that really don't lend themselves to easy categorization. That can be put in kind of a wastebasket category that we sometimes call functional pain, which is basically we don't know why you have pain. And it's probably a combination of things, but does sort of allow us to at least label it as something, and then we can kind of go after it in different ways.
Thanks. So what is the difference between acute pain and chronic pain?
Well, so acute pain is the pain that a person would feel in the short term after an injury. And we usually characterize acute pain as lasting up to about 6 weeks. So if you, just for the purposes of kind of putting labels on these things, if you were to say a common injury like a really bad strain of a back, somebody my age, like in their early 50s, bends down to pick something up and then just gets a really sharp pain in their back, you would say that that's an acute pain. And once you get to that 6 week mark, we have actually another label before you get to chronic, which is called subacute. And the acute to subacute happens at around 6 weeks and goes to about 12 weeks. And then at 12 weeks, we start to think of a pain as chronic, even though, like where I work in a chronic pain specialty clinic, most of the patients that we're seeing there have pain conditions that have lasted well beyond 12 weeks. They're more in the realm of a year, 2 years, 5 years, 12 weeks, it would be unusually short to wind up in the care of a pain specialty group. But for the purposes of the definition, we think of acute up to 6 weeks and then subacute 6 to 12 weeks, chronic 12 weeks or beyond.
Thanks. So building on that, what are some of the most common causes of chronic pain?
Well, I mentioned the example of low back pain. That is really, by a significant margin, the most common. Then we have the various headache syndromes are quite common. And when I say various, you have different types of headaches that people can have, including tension headaches, which are kind of the most typical stress-related or sometimes influenced by lack of sleep or inadequate nutrition or hydration. So those are tension headaches. Migraine headaches would be another type. And then you have a variety of different joint pain conditions, like I mentioned arthritis earlier, and I was talking about autoimmune arthritis, but even more common than that would be the type of arthritis that's more due to just wear and tear over time. And that's called osteoarthritis, otherwise known as degenerative joint disease. So you can have arthritis pretty much in any joint, including, say, your shoulders, your knees, your hips, your foot and ankle area, or in your back. And those are very common pain conditions. And then we have certain conditions that, I mentioned the back. I should also mention the neck. You can have chronic neck pain, whether it's due to something in the spine, like a disc problem, or you can have arthritis in the neck area of the spine. I was going to mention more central pain conditions, like something called fibromyalgia, which is like a generalized body pain that's caused from a variety of factors, and we don't even understand it extremely well. And then there are other hard to define pain conditions like irritable bowel syndrome, et cetera. So, and then of course, you know, you can have a disease like cancer. You can have a more serious inflammatory gastrointestinal disease like Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis and have pain from these chronic diseases that is fairly directly related to the disease. So as you can see, it's kind of a long list, but these are all the kind of most common things that we see in practice.
Yeah. So from what I've read, it seems like it's sometimes challenging for doctors to treat chronic pain. What are some of the different treatments used for chronic pain and how effective are they?
Well, yes, it's true that treating chronic pain is generally not a real easy or straightforward prospect. And I think part of the challenge is that the existence of chronic pain quite often defies easy explanation. And what I mean by that is, as opposed to, say, a person with that autoimmune arthritis condition, rheumatoid arthritis, where we know kind of what's happening anatomically, why that person is getting joint pain as a chronic problem. That is something we can understand well, and there are treatments for that condition. In addition to treating the symptoms of pain, we can also treat the disease. However, there are very often conditions of less clear cause where, say, a person with back pain starts off with an injury and it, you know, it gets to that subacute time frame, it turns into chronic, you know, we're now into months and it's not getting better. And then maybe the patient winds up having some procedures done for their pain. Maybe it starts with an injection in the back with the idea to try to bring down inflammation. Maybe they have a herniated intervertebral disc, which is in between the vertebral bones. We have these little discs that can sort of sometimes get out of place and create impingement on nerves of the spine. And so we'll do things like inject medicine in there. Occasionally people will then, if that doesn't work, they'll go and have surgery. The surgery from an anatomic standpoint may look on an imaging test like it did what it was supposed to do. But often enough, in fact, in a fairly significant percentage of the time, those patients don't necessarily experience the type of improvement in pain that we would hope and expect from what everyone was hoping, you know, from say a surgery. And so there is a common example of where the pain kind of lingers on despite everyone's intentions to treat it as directly as possible from a structural standpoint. And what we're left with is the patient saying, I'm still having a lot of pain, and they're feeling demoralized. A lot of cases, it's impacted their life to the point where they may not be able to work at this point. They may have had a lot of tension in some of their relationships because their pain has taken up such a tremendous amount of space in their life, and it's affecting the way they interact with others. They may not be sleeping well. They're being treated for this pain with medications, you know, most of the time, and the medications may further impact their ability to engage in the world and live life with energy and with competence at what they want to be doing. And so the point is that their existence is now at a place where a simple procedure is no longer going to be effective to help this person kind of get out of what's turned into really almost a new identity for them as this person with chronic pain that's really impacted their life significantly. So that's where quite often we need to kind of put a team together of practitioners who can come at this chronic pain problem from a variety of perspectives. We still want to look at, is there something procedurally or anatomically that is driving this that we missed, or maybe the surgery didn't quite fix this, but can we do that? So we don't want to give up looking at that, but we want to take the emphasis off of that, take it off the structural and anatomic focus, and put it more into the holistic. Okay, so we have this pain condition. We've come at it from a structural approach. It hasn't been successful. How do we get this person to actually increase their functional engagement and their day-to-day activity level so that, you know, even if there's still some pain there, they're not in such a demoralized place psychologically and their body is doing more. And maybe that could translate into more of a sense of contentedness, happiness, satisfaction, et cetera. And so there you're often needing to include things like psychological counseling to improve the patient's coping skills and to get them to look at this as, okay, we're now trying to get out of what can we do to fix this? And we're getting more into what can we do to bring our functional capacity up and sort of get to a level of acceptance that a cure or a simple solution is probably not what we should be looking at right now. There may be some things that are designed to, in a safe and sustainable way, to treat the pain. An example of that from my practice is acupuncture. You mentioned it in the introduction. So I went out of my way to learn medical acupuncture from early in my career as a way to offer something that I knew I could keep coming back to with the patient and have it be kind of a maintenance treatment for somebody who has been through, say, other treatments, or they want to avoid those other treatments like surgery. They want to do something that they can do on a relatively routine or regular basis that might bring their baseline level of pain down. It might prevent flares. It might be something they can just call upon with regularity that, again, it's not aiming to cure it, but it's aiming to contain it, manage it, and make the patient a little less bothered by the pain on a day-to-day basis. And so that might be something to engage with. You know, medications is always a part of the conversation. By the time people make it to my clinic, a lot of them have been prescribed a variety of different medications, and some of them are kind of notoriously double-edged sword. And by that, I mean, we know there are potential benefits and harms with certain medications. And I would say, you know, opioids being the big headline grabbing example, but even, you know, some of the other ones that are not necessarily controlled substances, but can be impairing just from, say, sedating effects or impairing effects that they have. We do have to be very thoughtful about the medications we prescribe and the combinations that they have, you know, when you put them together. So, and really what we're aiming for, and I should mention specifically also physical therapy, which is another sort of, if you look at this as a wheel with a variety of spokes, physical therapy is quite often a pretty key component. And again, talk about somebody who's been through surgery and is now at a pretty significantly lower level of functioning than before they first developed this back condition. A lot of people develop not only a routine of less activity, but they really develop a fear of movement and activity. And they've kind of convinced themselves, consciously or not, that the more active they are, the more pain they're going to have. And so they really retreat from activity. And so that's where physical therapy can be super helpful, because a good physical therapist will really try to work with patients in a supportive, gentle way to break through that fear of movement and fear of activity, and try to just very slowly and progressively push through that and really encourage the patient to engage in daily physical activity. And what we know is that generally the patients who do best and manage their pain best, quite often they're the ones who are the most engaged in physical activity and moving the most. And so again, you know, we really have to almost sort of start from ground zero with a lot of these folks with these different approaches. We might have to take them off a bunch of medications, start over with a new medicine or combination of medicines. We may have to get them moving again. We may have to start them on counseling. And a lot of them, maybe they never have done any counseling around their pain condition. So it's really quite, you're looking up at from the bottom of a mountain and looking at a kind of a longer term rehabilitation process. But when you put all the pieces together and you get people working with a patient and the patient is truly engaged, we do see some people do great. Do they still have pain? Generally, yes. But most of the time, they're able to verbalize a significant improvement in their level of functional capacity and activity. And that's really how we define success. It's not necessarily what the number is on a 0 to 10 scale of how bad their pain is. Of course, we'd like it to come down, but we really would prefer to have the yardstick be, am I able to do more? Am I able to tolerate more? Am I able to play with my grandkids or do my own grocery shopping or drive a car? Things that I was either, you know, unable to do or was too afraid to try before.
Yeah. So you mentioned opioids in the treatment of chronic pain. So let's talk about those for a bit. Can you briefly review how opioids produce analgesia?
Without getting into getting too wonky on the pharmacology with you, I think the best answer is to say that there are different types of opioid receptors in the body, and producing pain relief is generally thought to occur mostly at the mu opioid receptor, as in the Greek letter mu. There are other opioid receptors involved in pain processing as well, but pretty much all of the common opioids that you hear about that are prescribed for pain have some activity at the mu opioid receptor, most of them. And the other opioid receptors that are involved in, you know, that activated, or some of them actually are shut off by certain opioids, these subtle differences in how potent they are, say at the mu opioid receptor, what do they do at the other opioid receptors? These types of differences are what characterizes the differences between these drugs, as well as how long they last in the body, because that's a big variable, how quickly they get working and how long they stick around before they wear off, how much they affect the brain. Some opioids cross what we call the blood-brain barrier and affect the brain more than others. And so as a category, they do all have activity at opioid receptors, but exactly what they do at the opioid receptors, which opioid receptors they affect, how potent the effect is, how long they last in the body, these are all things that are quite different individually, depending on which opioid you're talking about.
So are opioids effective in treating chronic pain?
Well, that's a great question. And you might think that there's a really straightforward answer, but it's actually something that only in recent years has been looked at in ways that we're starting to understand better. The reason that we've had trouble really answering that question confidently is that a lot of the FDA trials on these opioid medicines that have come out over the years, they tend to only last, the trials only tend to last about 3 months. So, you know, when a drug is brought to the United States and when a company comes out with a new product, you know, say a synthetic opioid or a variation on an existing opioid, and they want to get their new product approved by the FDA and put on the United States market, they have to go through a fairly rigorous process. And, you know, most people have been hearing a lot about FDA approval in the context of recent COVID vaccines and other things, but basically every FDA approved medication has to go through a rigorous process demonstrating safety, effectiveness, and kind of a analysis of the different side effects that can be associated, et cetera. And when you think about it, if you're only testing an opioid for 3 months and you're dealing with patients who very often end up on these medications for well over a year, quite often 2 years, 5 years, you know, 10 years, the effects of the drug over that length of period of time, it's really quite different from what it looks like during those first 3 months. And so where that has left us is we've had a lot of opioids make it through the FDA approval process and get put on the market. But it's only, as I said, in the last few years, we have had some research attention being put on trials that are looking at longer term effects. I'll just mention one briefly that came out, I want to say 2018, I hope I'm correct. That was a study out of the Minnesota Veterans Administration program. And the lead author was a physician named Dr. Krebs, K-R-E-B-S, where they took, this was again, veteran population, and they had half of the population, and they were all patients that had either low back pain or knee osteoarthritis. And I just told you those were examples of the common pain conditions that I mentioned earlier. So they are certainly common in the veteran population. So they all had low back pain or knee arthritis. None of the patients were on opioids prior to the research trial. And they took roughly half of them and treated them with opioids and, quote, usual care, which in their case involved some counseling and some physical therapy, some other things. And then they took the other half and they did not provide opioids and gave them other pain relievers, such as anti-inflammatory pain relievers and acetaminophen, et cetera, muscle relaxant. And they looked all the way out to a year. So again, you know, the difference between a year and 3 months is, may not sound like that much, but it is. And what they found out was that at the end of the year, the patients who were given opioids actually had more what we call pain interference. That is, they reported that the pain bothered them more than the patients who were not given opioids. And in terms of the kind of raw scores of pain levels, which is different from pain interference, they were statistically equivalent. So those are subjective measures of pain, how much it interferes and how bad is it on a 0 to 10 scale. And people on opioids were either the same or worse on those measures. And then on the third major question they asked was side effects. Who had the worst side effects? And you could probably guess the patients on opioids had worse side effects. So that study was pretty important because it did show that after a year of being on opioids, not only was the pain not better controlled, but the patients were probably less functional because they were dealing with more adverse effects from the medication. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, that's the kind of study, and it's not the only one, but, you know, I thought I would at least use it as an example where when I talk to young doctors in training, you know, in their residency, and they want to know, you know, what's the role of opioids for these patients that I'm seeing, you know, who come in with chronic pain, I tell them that based on the best evidence we have right now, I don't think you should necessarily start somebody on an opioid without a fairly clear endpoint in mind. Because again, what we can say to the patient is, we don't have great evidence that starting you on this medicine today, if we ask you in a year, has this medicine been helpful, we'll probably get a negative response. And so do we want to be starting that for somebody? Probably not. You know, we want to be educating the patient that you may tell me next week that your pain is a little bit better, you know, after I gave you this medication. But, you know, our job as doctors, when we're dealing with chronic pain, we need to think beyond today, tomorrow, next week, next month. We need to be thinking about what's going to be sustainable and helpful to my patient over time. And of course, there are sometimes in between things, maybe there's a reason why their pain is spiking to a severe level now, and we can get them on and off quickly. And it wouldn't, I'm not trying to be too black and white here. There may be a role for opioids, you know, here and there, but I'm saying putting somebody on and saying, well, let's just see how it goes. That's what kind of got us into what we're dealing with now, this whole opioid crisis thing that, you know, everybody's hearing about. The first wave of that was over prescription of painkillers by well-intentioned doctors, but they were being told by marketing representatives and false science that giving, say, you know, an elderly patient with arthritis a very strong opioid painkiller was going to be a smart thing or a humane thing to do. And when in fact, what we've learned is we really should be choosing very carefully in terms of selection, which are appropriate candidates for opioid therapy. And, you know, again, this is a conundrum that we're still trying to figure out. And even those of us who've been doing this a long time, there are patients that come into my office and they're asking me my opinion. And I'm telling them, I would love you to not have to rely on an opioid. And if you're already on one, I can probably help you rely less on it. And the ones that come in and say, I think I need to be on one, we have to have a conversation because, again, these are not black and white situations.
Yeah. So this kind of connects with what you were talking about, especially with the study with the veterans. Mm-hmm. So I read about something called opioid-induced hyperalgesia. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. you know, so I was wondering if you could explain, you know, how that works and how it's different from opioid tolerance.
Yeah, that's a great question. The concept of opioid-induced hyperalgesia is something that generally happens when a patient has been on opioids for a relatively lengthy period of time, at least months, quite often years, where they've usually developed tolerance, which is, you know, kind of the first step in the process of your body starting to become habituated or sensitized to the pain relieving effects of the particular medicine and dose that you've been given. So if a patient is given, say, 5 milligrams of a certain opioid for 6 months or a year, they start telling their doctor, you know, I just don't think it's really helping anymore. It feels like maybe I've gotten some tolerance to this. Mm-hmm. That's tolerance. And that's really defined by just diminishing effectiveness over time. That's something that I think everybody understands, whether you're a medical person or a lay person. The thing you asked about, opioid-induced hyperalgesia, is where not only has your body developed tolerance to where the medicine isn't having the same effect anymore, but those opioid pathways that are producing what's supposed to be a therapeutic benefit of pain relief, there's been kind of a under-the-radar, subtle, gradual combination of changes happening at a molecular level that have wound up dialing up your pain sensitivity. And keep in mind, our nervous systems are extremely complex. We have factors that dial up our pain, say in response to an acute injury, which is an adaptive thing. We want to feel pain when we've injured ourselves, right? That's going back to human evolutionary biology. If we were going to survive as a species, we need to feel pain. And then we have coming from the brain, coming down the spine, because we have the pain signals are coming up the spine from the peripheral body. We're actually feeling the pain as those signals reach our brain and they get to what's called the sensory cortex of the brain, which is where the pain is processed and you can actually feel it. If you didn't have a brain with a sensory cortex, you wouldn't feel any pain. Okay, so that's the ascending pain signals coming up the brain. And then we have descending signals that actually are helpful in dampening down that pain ascending feedback so that it's kind of an inhibitory input. to dampen down those signals. And so what's happening when you have opioid-induced hyperalgesia is that system is kind of getting out of whack, along with just even the different chemicals involved in this, because it's not just opioids, but it's chemicals with names like glutamate and our body's other chemicals involved in pain processing, where the certain chemicals can get dialed up in a state of hyperalgesia, and other chemicals that are meant to damp down pain can get dialed down. And so the system gets out of whack. There is medical literature on opioid-induced hyperalgesia, but your question is astute, because it's actually something that doesn't get talked about that much. You know, I don't mean to say that it isn't something that doctors have heard of. It's just quite frequent when a patient with chronic pain will come in and consult with me, and I bring up this idea of, do you think it's possible that your pain sensitivity has gotten worse as you've been on opioids all this time? And I talk to them about opioid-induced hyperalgesia. I let them know there's literature on it. It's not something that really there's much debate about. We do accept that it exists. And the patients quite often haven't had any conversation with their prior, you know, even their current physician who's prescribing them their medications, or other physicians they've seen in the past. So there's an under recognition of this. And I like to really highlight it, because some of the treatments that we have to offer can actually really help people get out of that state of tolerance and hyperalgesia. And that's a big step towards feeling better, actually, for a lot of these patients who have kind of been stuck on higher dose opioids for a long time. And nobody's really told them, you know, hey, not only might these be impairing and, you know, you're kind of able to do less, you can't drive, you can't remember stuff well. Not only that, but you might be in more pain. What a radical, you know, thought that is, but no one's told them. And when we can intervene and make changes on that alone, we can sometimes really improve someone's quality of life. And that's something I get a chance to do a lot in my practice, just based on my particular skill set, if you will, is helping people make those kinds of changes.
Yeah. Thank you for explaining that. That was very helpful. So if a healthcare provider, you know, does decide to prescribe opioids for pain, what can they do to minimize the risks associated with that?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And again, like, we don't want to be overly sort of damning of the role of opioids. There's certainly situations with acute pain, for example, where it is considered appropriate and, in fact, humane to prescribe opioids. Mm-hmm. It's really when we get into the chronic scenario where the value of them is questionable. But what we often want to do is we want to use, if we can, we want to use validated tools to screen for who could be the patients that would misuse the prescription or engage in kind of unsafe behaviors with them. And there are a variety of those tools available, and most of them just take a minute or two tops, you know, and can be done, say, while the patient's in the exam room waiting for the doc to come in. You know, the medical assistant says, can you please fill this out? And you know, we have something documented that we can scan into the medical record that gets at that question of as close as we can, because, you know, the patient is answering the questions, we hope honestly, but the fact is that there may be some, you know, less than perfect validity, but it's as good as we have. We look at what their response is and we say, okay, well, you have a real strong family history of substance use disorders, and you yourself had a, you know, a major problem with alcohol that, you know, you were able to get a handle on, which is great, about 3 years ago, and you've been abstinent from alcohol ever since. Now you have this chronic pain condition, and we're trying to, you know, weigh the benefits versus harms of using opioids for this. You better believe that that personal history of a substance use disorder and that family history is going to potentially influence our thinking on, you know, the appropriateness of opioids. And it's not necessarily a, again, like, nothing is black and white, but let's say we do decide, okay, this is a condition, or this is, you know, this is an injury that the appropriate decision is to use an opioid. What that screening and use of the validated test would do for us is it might encourage us to be more vigilant in our monitoring. We might see the patient back for follow-up on a shorter time interval and more frequently. We might do other screening things like urine toxicology testing, checking the state database for other controlled substance prescriptions, you know, every time, which we should do anyway. But certain things that we do in clinical practice that we really use for our higher risk, quote unquote, higher risk patients, so that we can try to keep them on the right side of the line of, okay, we've got this opioid in the mix. We certainly don't want it to turn into anything harmful to the patient. We want to make sure that it has a therapeutic role versus a harmful role. So being real vigilant, and, you know, I find that speaking very openly with the patient, not trying to have kind of my own agenda of what I think and not sharing it with the patient. I mean, sometimes the patient isn't on the same page with you as the prescribing physician. And what they want is out of sync with what you think is best for them. And that's just sometimes a reality of clinical medicine, particularly when something like opioids are involved. It is, you know, sometimes the end result is the doc in their best judgment, or when I say doc, you know, the prescriber, the medical provider, their best judgment is to not prescribe or prescribe less or prescribe a different medicine or whatever the case is, something different from what the patient is asking for. And that can create tension. That can create the sort of vibe that none of us love when we're dealing with patients. We want our patients to like us. We want to have pleasant interactions. We want to be in sync. But at the end of the day, we're the ones signing the script. We're the ones who are going to be questioned if something bad happens to the patient. Did you know that that patient was using this or that substance and yet you still gave them, you know? So we do have to have those things in mind is the point. And it's kind of on us, you know, sometimes we miss stuff and we're human. Even those of us that are more experienced, you know, things get by us. And that's because we want to trust our patients. We want to believe what they tell us. You know, we're not sort of in the business of, like, you know, never believing what people tell us. So stuff will get past us sometimes. But to your question, if we're doing appropriate screening and we're speaking openly and with good communication, I think, you know, we can avoid a lot of that stuff. And it's going to be a pretty low percentage of the time when we're going to end up either hurting somebody or someone's going to be taking our prescription and selling it on the street or something inappropriate.
Yeah. So what do you do when you see a patient with a use disorder who requests treatment for acute pain or even for chronic pain?
Generally, the indications for use of an opiate medicine for chronic pain would be more or less incompatible with an active substance use disorder. In other words, there's very little, except for like end of life kind of cancer / palliative care. That's a separate category where it's like, okay, we're just going to be humane with this person because they don't have long to live. But for just about any other chronic condition, if I have someone who is actively using a substance in unhealthy fashion, such that prescribing them an opioid puts them at risk of overdose or other unsafe outcome, really the appropriateness of the opioid is at the very least highly questionable, if not, you know, I don't want to say it's an absolute contraindication, but it's pretty close. Someone has it can depend on the substance too, because not every substance is as dangerous as the other when it comes to the overdose risk. For example, people generally do not overdose on cannabis. And I'm not here to, like, you know, be an apologist for cannabis, but I am saying that when it comes to overdose, there's a difference between cannabis and, say, a high dose of a sedative like a benzodiazepine, which, whether you look at federal guidelines like the CDC opioid prescribing guidelines, or you look at, you know, just about any state guideline, it's best to avoid combinations of prescription opioids with sedatives. Alcohol is also a central nervous system depressant or sedative and is dangerous in combination with opioids. So a person who is using alcohol at high levels and, you know, and you have a safety issue with using opioids, that is also a risky situation. So now I was talking about chronic there. acute, you still have a responsibility to make safety the number one priority. You know, I would say that for the kind of pain that would require an opioid for someone who is, you know, a really, you know, engaging in problem substance use, most of the time it would have to be pain that requires a hospital visit or, you know, inpatient admission for opioids to be used safely. In other words, if somebody showed up in, it wouldn't necessarily be my clinic because I don't really see urgent care stuff, but if someone showed up in a primary care, you know, or an urgent care clinic, having fallen, broken their arm, and they're obviously intoxicated on alcohol, it would be highly questionable to give that patient an opioid medicine when they were intoxicated. You know, you would probably want to make sure that they got safely transported somewhere where they could be monitored. And again, like, no one wants to have an overdose occur because they were trying to be, you know, humane to a patient's pain complaint when essentially they didn't look at the safety factor of how is this medicine going to combine with what's going on with the patient. And so, you know, these are tough situations, but, you know, again, like, we're really duty bound to do no harm, you know, going back mm-hmm. to Hippocratic Oath. And patient with an arm fracture having pain, that's extremely unpleasant, but we certainly don't want that to turn into something life-threatening.
Yeah. What should doctors do if they find out that a patient is misusing the opioids that were prescribed for pain?
And it's a good question, because I tell you what the answer is not. The answer is not to, quote, discharge the patient from your practice, or, you know, fire the patient, or whatever mm-hmm. the way you want to put that. And unfortunately, that happens way too commonly. Patients are essentially abandoned when they're, quote, caught doing something they weren't supposed to be doing. And really, I don't fault a doctor for feeling like there's been a violation of trust and the relationship may never be the same. But we want to keep the patient in the medical system, ideally keep the patient with the same doctor providing care, but that care does not have to include opioids, especially if it was misuse that, I mean, there are levels of misuse, I guess is what I want to say. When you say misuse, it could mean, you know, their prescription allows for 3 tablets per day, and they come back at their follow-up visit and they tell you, you know, doc, I really had a hard month, and I took 4 on 2 days this month. I still made it through the month okay, and I'm not asking you for an early refill. I just wanted to let you know I took 4 2 days this month. That happens actually very commonly. And if you look at, like, the National Institute of Drug Abuse website, the last time I saw a measure of that, it was something like 78% of patients prescribed opioids for chronic pain have misused them. And again, that could be taking an extra pill. It might even be taking it at the wrong time of day from what it was supposed to be on the prescription, you know? So those would be more on the minor side. Then there's the ran out of a month's prescription in a week and a half. Instead of taking 3 a day, the patient was taking 8 or 9 a day, you know, and then just going through withdrawal and doing the whole thing again, you know, month to month, and the doctor wasn't catching them. They saved just enough to take a pill before they came in because they knew the doctor was going to give them a urine test, or maybe the doctor never gave them a urine test. So, you know, that's a dangerous situation because that patient is using in a way that it could be life-threatening combined with another central nervous system depressant, for example. And so the point I'm making is there is no answer to what the doc should do, but it's more of what they shouldn't do is abandon the patient. There should be a conversation. There should be an attempt to kind of quantify, objectify the situation a little bit with, say, urine toxicology screening, what's showing up on that day's urine test that we think should show up, what's showing up that that shouldn't show up, and sometimes what's not showing up that's supposed to, which could be an indication that the patient used all their stuff too quickly, or maybe they sold some or got rid of some or gave some away. So whatever the issue is, we need to try to get at it. Ideally, we can get honest answers from our patients. That's always the best. Some of that trust can be restored simply by speaking openly and honestly, and the doc saying, look, these medicines have a way of sometimes promoting taking an extra here and there. If you're having a bad day, you know, some people make that decision. It's not a good decision, but I'm not here to judge you. I just want to know the truth of what's going on so I can help you better. And I'll say one other thing about this is that I mentioned about how, you know, maybe someone's prescription says take 3 pills a day. Well, as I was mentioning earlier, you know, some of these medications last a certain amount of time in the body that's not very long. We might call them short acting opioids as opposed to other types of medicines that are relatively stable in your system and maybe even around the clock. And when somebody is told, if they're given a short acting opioid that lasts maybe 4 hours, or, you know, if they're lucky, 5 to 6, they're told take 3 a day, they're going to have periods of time where they're on the downslope of the active phase of that medication, and maybe even a number of hours where it's totally out of their system. That might affect not only their pain control, but it could affect their mood. It could affect their sleep, other aspects of their functioning, simply by the nature of the ups and downs on the medication. And so that, as you can imagine, if you have somebody who, you know, they may never have had any kind of substance use problem in their life, never were a problem drinker, never smoked cigarettes, anything like that, use recreational drugs, but you've put them on this medicine that only lasts 4 or 5 hours in their system. You say, only take it 3 times a day. It's hard for that patient to get through a 24-hour cycle with any sort of feeling of stability. It's just kind of an up and down existence all day, every day. And so I'm not apologizing for the patient who's making the choice to take extra medicine. I'm just saying that sometimes it's not a desire to kind of misuse or get a buzz off the medication or something. It's more of a desire to not have such pronounced ups and downs on pain control and other functional aspects. And really the problem is the design of the medication regimen, probably more so than the patient and their own, you know, decision-making. So someone like myself, who's thought a lot about this stuff, I can look at that, you know, if they come in and see me as a consultant, I can look at their medicine regimen and say, you know what, you're doing a lot of this up and down stuff with this medication all day, every day. And the patient really doesn't know anything different. You know, if they've been doing that for months or years, they haven't had another experience. They don't know that there's some other way of managing it that would be different and better. So it's up to me to say, here's what you've been doing. I'm telling you that there's another way of doing this. What do you think about going through a transition? You know, and then we can talk. So it's education is huge. And that's how we can deal with, you know, sometimes a lot of these misuse issues that aren't even, you know, we wouldn't put them in the category of a use disorder. We put them in the category of kind of medication management that has ceased. If it was ever effective, that it really is not now. And we're in a situation where the medicine's kind of more of a problem than a solution.
Thanks. So kind of backtracking for a little bit and referring back to opioid-induced hyperalgesia, are people who have an opioid use disorder more sensitive to pain?
You know, often, yes. And it's generally because of that opioid-induced hyperalgesia issue. Some of the studies that really elucidated the concept of opioid-induced hyperalgesia were done on patients who were being treated with methadone for opioid addiction. And your listeners may know or they may not, but methadone has been used to treat opioid addiction since the late 1960s, quite a long time. And there were studies done, I believe it was in the 80s, where they basically compared how did patients who were taking methadone, and they're generally pretty high doses when they're using it to treat addiction. How did someone on methadone for addiction who was given a cold stimulus to their finger, how was their pain response compared to someone else who had never been on opioids before? And as you might guess, the patients on methadone were more sensitive to the cold stimulus. So kind of a simple experiment, but it did exemplify this concept of opioid-induced hyperalgesia. And there have been other things along the way that have demonstrated that. But it's certainly been my clinical experience, just anecdotally, that I do see hyperalgesia very commonly. You know, and as I said earlier, it's kind of low-hanging fruit in a way for engaging the patient to make changes that would generally not only make them less impaired in other ways because of their opioids, but it might also really help improve their pain if we can get them out of hyperalgesia. And so it's really worth taking the time, but it is one of those things you have to sit down and explain this concept to the patient, which kind of blows their mind a little bit. Like, you mean you're telling me that this medicine I've been getting for years, everyone is telling me is my pain medicine, is making my pain worse? You know, it's like the world is flat. What's going on here? You know, so it's not an easy conversation. But if you can back up your words with, you know, I try to find the balance. And I don't want to be quoting studies and printing up journal articles to every time I meet with patients, but I want to sound like I know what I'm talking about. I want to explain these things. And I also want to let them absorb the information so that if they're seeing me and they've been on a medicine for years and I'm the first one telling them about this, and I say, hey, I've got this other choice that we could do that will probably reboot those opioid pathways and help you get out of hyperalgesia, I can walk you through that. And I feel good about recommending that. You know, I don't want to come down too aggressively on the patient. I want to say, you know, we can call this an educational visit and a, you know, offer of options and, you know, ideas. And you can go back and talk to your doc who refers you, your primary care. And I'm here if you want to come back in a month and we can talk about transitioning this other medicine or whatever you want to do. You know, I try to be low key about it and just, you know, because I've gotten to know patients want to trust that your agenda is their agenda, which is, you know, it should be. But part of that is, you know, when you hit them with a new concept that's so counterintuitive, like this hyperalgesia thing, you got to let it sit. You know, and some people will actually kind of right away, they'll look at you and they'll go, my goodness, no one ever told me that, but that just makes all the sense in the world. I feel like I have been in more pain these last couple of years, and like the docs have raised my dose several times. So sometimes it really resonates immediately, and other times you need to let it sit.
Yeah. What about opioid agonists like buprenorphine or methadone? Are these effective for the treatment of chronic pain in people with an opioid use disorder?
Yes, and I'm glad you mentioned buprenorphine and methadone, and I'll handle them separately because they really are quite different pharmacologically from each other. And, you know, I could spend a whole hour talking about each of them and still have more to talk about. But what I would say, first of all, is they are both used in the treatment of chronic pain. In fact, they were both designed and used as pain medicines before they were ever used in treatment of addiction. I mentioned earlier that methadone was first used in the 60s to treat addiction, but it had been around for decades as a pain medicine. And buprenorphine, a lot of people, especially in the United States, have a very kind of misinformed understanding of the role of buprenorphine in chronic pain, you know, if it has one. And they are surprised to learn that buprenorphine was also designed and used as a pain medicine before it was ever used in treatment of addiction. One of the reasons that people are so ill-informed or, you know, have the wrong understanding about buprenorphine, as far as that goes, is that buprenorphine was only available in one formulation before 2002, and that was a liquid solution that was used in the hospital only and given like intravenously. And so it wasn't used in the real world, like in an outpatient basis ever. And it wasn't commonly used in the hospital either, but it existed. In 2002, the FDA did approve the first outpatient buprenorphine product, which is the sublingual or dissolving under the tongue formulation of buprenorphine. The brand name that most people have heard of is Suboxone. And so some people just call buprenorphine Suboxone, but I like to use the name of the opioid, which is buprenorphine, because it does come in a variety of different formulations. But, you know, that product came out in 2002, and the FDA approved indication, which was sought by the company that put it to the FDA to get approved, that indication was opioid addiction, you know, as the parlance of the time was. Now we call it opioid use disorder. And when it was introduced to the market at that time, not only was that the indication, but they put a bunch of rules around who was able to prescribe it. They essentially mandated that any doctor who was going to prescribe it for treatment of addiction had to go through a training course. It's not a huge deal, like an 8-hour course, but they had to go through this course to learn some about the details of the medication pharmacologically and how to use it, how to prescribe it. And then they had to, once they did the course, they had to apply to the United States DEA to get a separate DEA license number, distinct from their regular DEA license number that they used to write prescriptions for other opioids and controlled substances. You know, and that took time. You had to do the course, then apply, and then, you know, took time. Then you get this letter saying, okay, here's your number for your buprenorphine prescription. So you can imagine that not every doctor went out of their way to do a course and do this whole DEA application. And it was really just weirdos like myself who were interested in addiction, found it interesting and compelling to try to treat people. You know, we were the ones who went out of our way to do this training and get our DEA number to prescribe buprenorphine. And again, that was the product that came out that was the first buprenorphine outpatient product. Now, at that time, we didn't really know much about buprenorphine as a pain reliever. We knew next to nothing. But, you know, the information was there. There were papers out. It's just that the average doc, you know, when I was coming out of addiction medicine training, I just knew I needed this. And, you know, then I wound up in a pain specialty treatment setting and I started using it because I was running into people with co-occurring chronic pain and opioid use disorder or just opioid issues. And I was putting them on buprenorphine and I was observing that they were doing really well with their pain. And then we started to, you know, as I said, we started to learn more about the pharmacology. And then 2010, another buprenorphine product came out that was FDA approved for treatment of pain, transdermal or patch form of buprenorphine. And another product came out in 2015 that was a dissolving in the cheek or buccal buprenorphine product. And that those are both FDA approved for pain, not for addiction. In other words, you can't use them for addiction. You have to use them for pain. And ironically, they're lower dose buprenorphine than the under the tongue one that was FDA approved for treatment of addiction. And it's not that the higher dose doesn't work for pain. It's just that, you know, the FDA approval process and the marketing factors that led that company to seek their indication to be opioid addiction, that's what happened. You know, it was that process that led to sublingual buprenorphine being perceived by basically everybody as the drug that's used to treat addiction. And there wasn't as much attention paid to these other buprenorphine products when they came out. So even now, you know, fast forward, this is, you know, 2022, it's been 20 years since sublingual buprenorphine came out and 12 and 7 respectively, the other products came out. There's still a lot of people who don't know that buprenorphine is actually a very potent pain reliever. It's a high potency opioid for pain. There is no ceiling effect on the pain relief from buprenorphine, as opposed to, you know, a lot of people know about the ceiling effect it has on respiratory depression. In other words, you can go up on the dose and you're not going to subject the patient to higher risk of overdose from respiratory depression. Unlike other opioids where you go up on the dose, like say fentanyl, and you stop breathing and don't wake up. Buprenorphine has a very uniquely safe combination of high potency pain relief, yet lack of respiratory depression because of that ceiling effect. But a lot of people think there's a ceiling effect on the pain part of it as well. So again, you know, these are pharmacologic details that are kind of lost. And, you know, one thing that the opioid crisis has done is it has risen the profile of buprenorphine quite a bit because, you know, a lot of these articles that folks are looking at in the news or, you know, shows that are being, you know, put on TV about the opioid crisis, they talk about buprenorphine. And it's great that they do because it is still underutilized in the treatment of addiction, even with all the press it's gotten as an evidence-based, you know, really is a first-line treatment, meaning we shouldn't just be giving it to some people who've had significant opioid addiction problems. It should be something we're really giving to people, especially nowadays with the overdose rates so high with fentanyl, synthetic fentanyl products, you know, illicit fentanyl on the street causing so many overdoses. We should be giving people buprenorphine, getting them off fentanyl. But my point is that attention that's been paid to buprenorphine is really external to its use in pain. And so more people know about it, but you know, those people aren't being told about, oh, and it's really good for chronic pain too. You know, that is almost never really, you know, mentioned. And so I have found that I'm having to kind of re-educate or kind of correct misinformation a lot when it comes to the utility of buprenorphine as a pain medicine. I'll just talk about methadone briefly. Methadone is used in pain as well, but it's become a medicine that we've all become much more careful and selective about when, as far as choosing it as a pain medicine. What we learned, I can speak to my state specifically, which is Washington State. There was a period of time, you know, and this is while I was in, you know, relatively early in my practice in the early 2000s, where the Medicaid program of Washington State only covered two long-acting opioids on their formulary. If you were on Medicaid, you could only get one of two opioids. One of them was methadone, which is a long-acting opioid. The other one was an extended-release morphine. So those were the only two that were covered. Well, there was some research done by the Washington State Department of Labor and Industries. It was some of the earliest research that showed the relationship between prescription opioids and overdose deaths that were happening kind of in that 2008 to 10 range. And really looking back on that period of time, the fact that methadone was being used was one of the key factors, because methadone is a tricky drug. It is very long acting and it takes days or even a week for when you start somebody on methadone for that, the levels to kind of get stabilized to where the patient is at a stable level if they're dosing it, you know, say two or three times a day for pain as opposed to once a day when they're taking it for addiction in a methadone clinic. So a lot of doctors who don't know this, they might be raising the patient's dose too quickly, too early. You know, if the patient's saying it's not helping yet, it's not helping yet. And it's dangerous, you know, on the early side of the prescription. And of course, later it can be as well. But the point is that methadone, unlike buprenorphine, does have a significant risk of overdose if used too aggressively, too quickly, when the patient has not kind of achieved a steady state level and kind of a level where any changes are very minor, you know, and can be handled by the patient. So we've learned a lot from those experiences. And you know, generally what I tell docs is if you're not experienced with methadone, you probably ought to leave it to a pain specialist or someone who is experienced with it. It's just not something that, say, the average primary care doc should necessarily dabble in if they really don't see themselves doing it with some regularity, because it is a tricky medicine. So as far as like a head-to-head comparison, who would I like to have on which medication? I would always prefer to have someone on buprenorphine if I get a choice, because it generally does a really good job on pain control, sometimes a phenomenal job, generally more than adequate for someone who does need a long-acting opioid, which is not every patient with pain, mind you, of course, but if they need a long-acting opioid, I'd much rather have them on buprenorphine than methadone. But I do have some people who, you know, whatever the circumstances are, they couldn't tolerate buprenorphine, which happens, you know, rarely, but it does happen, or whatever the circumstances. And I do have some people who are on methadone for pain and are doing okay. So again, none of this stuff is black and white. But that's kind of the evolution. I hope I answered the question.
Yeah, that was definitely a very informative answer. So yes, thank you.
Thank you.
So moving on, are there any new treatments for chronic pain on the horizon?
Well, I myself am someone who tends to be sort of low tech in my way of looking at best practices for chronic pain management. I do practice with partners in my group who are really on the cutting edge of some of the technological advances that are happening in the realm of, say, nerve stimulation, implantable devices that are out. And, you know, there are some particular indications, like patients who've been through back surgery. They call the condition failed back surgery syndrome, where someone has had back surgery and continues to have really high impact, low back pain, and quite often symptoms that are shooting down their legs, radiculopathy pain. And there's some pretty good evidence that spinal cord implantable stimulation devices can be not only helpful symptomatically, but also a cost-effective treatment. And so that's just one example of a high-tech intervention that, you know, I'm around some people who are doing research on that and are using that. I tend to really more, you know, think about the holistic approach. And I like to emphasize that with patients, that any particular intervention that we offer, however high tech or cutting edge, we generally don't want to ignore the other aspects of life that are sort of touched upon by pain, or vice versa, that might have influenced your development of the pain condition to begin with. And some of those things even go back to childhood, like, you know, what we call adverse childhood experiences. Mm-hmm. There's lots of research that goes into the effects of childhood trauma, or just even more recent stressors in patients' lives, divorce, spousal abuse, even job loss, things like this, that are very impactful to a patient and how they perceive their pain. Again, you know, pain is very subjective, and a person's, quote, pain experience isn't necessarily going to correlate to what shows up on an imaging test or a blood test or something objectively quantifiable. You could have two people with the same exact findings on, say, a knee x-ray, and person A has 8, 9, 10 out of 10 pain, and person B has 1 or 2 out of 10 pain. And a lot of the factors that involve those differences might be more in the realm of what's going on in the central nervous system, not in the nerves that are sending those signals from the knee. Those are peripheral nerves. But again, those signals are being sent up through the spinal cord and into the brain through the central nervous system and all the processing that's happening there. And that's where things like trauma experiences, current mental health issues, there's also just the basic biology of our nervous system, that some people are wired with more pain sensitivity than others, you know, just the way some people respond differently to certain medications than others. So all these complex combinations of factors, we can't necessarily think overly structurally. And that's, you know, that's the original point that I made when we started our discussion. We need to be looking at the whole person and offering treatments that are holistic in the sense of, you know, looking at the various facets of the patient's life and not just what's happening at the site where their pain is. Of course, we want to do what we can in that realm, but, you know, if we ignore the other stuff, it's going to really be compromising the outcome. And, you know, the patient will probably do okay or not do okay based on how thorough and holistic we are with our approach.
Yeah. So finally, is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, really just, I do want to send a message of hope to folks listening, that we, you know, those of us that are out there trying to help these patients, we do see people get better. And that includes patients with chronic pain, that includes patients with substance use disorders. Generally, the patients that get better are the ones that come for help and are willing to work with us and kind of partner with us and put energy into the things that we're talking about and recommending, both, you know, as far as treatment things that we may have to offer, as well as things in the realm of self-care and things they can do in their own lives. But patients generally do get better when they're engaged and when they make a choice. I'm going to deal with this tough situation the best I can, and I'm going to let these people kind of take me for a journey and let's see where we go. Those are the patients that tend to do well. The ones who are waiting for, you know, the miracle cure to come around and fix everything quite often wind up disappointed and frustrated and complaining that no one has been able to figure out how to help them. So it's, you know, and we always wish we could wave the magic wand. You know, we would love to be able to do that. But the reality is it takes a village. It's a team approach quite often to get folks, you know, and that includes their own, you know, support network at home and people that in their lives. But even, you know, within our treatment, it's the people on the treatment team. And then it's, you know, it's a lot of it is attitude and self-care and trying to put a positive spin on life in a way that is actually ritualized, you know, and it's intentional. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that is how good things start to happen. And you can get really deep into philosophy on this stuff if you want. Maybe it's for another episode, but I do want to send that message of hope. And you know, no one should ever say, you know, I'm not even going to bother with trying to get better. You know, there's nothing that's going to help me, because there's always something. There is always something.
Yeah. I want to thank you again, Dr. Rudolph, for taking the time to discuss the management of chronic pain with us. This was a very enlightening session, and you answered all of my questions and probably many of the questions of our listeners as well.
Well, I want to thank you again, Ahana, for inviting me, and you're doing great work here. Thanks. And I still can't believe you're only in high school putting all this together, but I want to just give you all the kudos possible, and it was my pleasure.
Thank you.